Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Salier Report. We have a very special report. This will be public. We have Dr. Lyons Weiler from Pennsylvania, my old stomping ground, who is a research scientist. I'm going to have him tell you more about him, but this is a man who, as he said, is allergic to fake science. And he communicates that with such it's always inspirational to see his videos. We posted many of them, so it's a real thrill to finally get him on the Salier Report. So your friends call you Jack. May I call you Jack?
Absolutely, Catherine. Okay. Thank you. Such an honor to be here. Thank you.
Thank you so much. You have a huge new publication with Dr. Paul Thomas, which we're going to talk about, and you also have information you're challenging to the FDA and the health regulators. But before we dive into that, I want our audience to know a little bit more about you, what you're doing, and most of all, how to stay current with your work, how to plug in, how to support you, because I think you are, you know, if Leonardo da Vinci was alive today, he'd be helping you.
That's a really high compliment. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Know,
growing up through through scientific training as a biologist and getting into medical research, it was always a square peg, round hole kind of thing, because people would say you can't both be analytic and creative. You can't use both sides of your brain. I'm a musician, I'm a songwriter, and I'm a scientist as well. And you know, the degree of specialization that goes on right now in science is absolutely ludicrous, ridiculous. People don't just study an organism. They study not a particular gene, they study a particular promoter, and now they're studying a particular variant in a promoter, and that's that they get that.
Well, but here's the thing. If you're using science for control and political purposes, that's how you want knowledge management to work. It's the same in the financial area. You bifurcate and keep separate, and that way you can do fake finance along with fake science.
Exactly. Right. And early in my training, I had a genetics professor, Dr. Peter Rosenbaum at SUNY Oswego, upstate New York, who said, you do not specialize. Generalize, but master everything. So what I learned was I didn't want ever to do publications that just added a little tiny leaf to the tree of knowledge. I wanted to take the trunk of the tree of knowledge and shake it at its assumptions and see if the tree of knowledge grew again, what would we know if our assumptions are wrong?
Right.
So I'm skeptical of assumptions. There's a logical way to approach science that you never allow yourself any type of bias except for the limitations of what you know, the background knowledge. But anyway, I'm a biologist by training. I went into genetics. I went into paleoecology. I have...
I don't even know what that is.
Well, that's the study of past climate change and changes in vegetation. I did research in the Amazon rainforest. And then I did desert ecology. I mapped out rare species in the Intermountain West to find out where the richest species variation was. But when I came into phylogenetics and tried to understand how species are related to each other evolutionarily, there was a methodological problem. The methodological problem was that when you infer these relationships, you make some assumptions in making the tree, say, of humans, chimps, gorillas, orangutans, whatever, and no matter what you're studying, you then base everything you're saying on the assumption that the tree is correct, when in reality, you could get a tree from random data. And no one really kind of emphasized that. There were a few people talking about it, but I went to my math base, and I went statistical on it to say, maybe we can actually study patterns in the data and see when we're making that mistake.
Right.
That gave me my career, basically. I published 12 papers. My PhD dissertation committee, the first meeting, I handed them 12 peer-reviewed publications. And they thought it was background reading. They thought it was written by other people. And I said, no, this is my dissertation. What do you think about it? And one guy quit. He said, I want to, you're way ahead of me. I can't help you. I'm not suitable. And so then what happened was I went into molecular evolution at Penn State University. I was on a Sloan postdoctoral fellow, an FNP Sloan postdoc with the Department of Energy. And 1 year to that, Mark Boguski, who's a pathologist, 1 year after I started there, Mark Boguski, a pathologist, came in to Penn State University and gave a presentation on this new technology that allowed us to measure 40,000 genes at a time. And
wow.
Because we could do that, I saw the parallels in the data analysis problems from before. And so I went to my postdoctoral advisor, a Japanese guy named Masatoshi Ne, a National Academy of Sciences member, and I said, if it's all right with you, I think molecular evolution is important, but Mom died from breast cancer, and they're going to mess this up. Can I go over into bioinformatics? Can I help create the field of bioinformatics? And so I was hired at University of Massachusetts. I set up a bioinformatics core. Then the University of Pittsburgh found me because I had put out software to allow people to do the analysis I was doing. And then I became so popular at the University of Pittsburgh, they gave me a research course so I could help people do what I was doing. And that fit me to a T. I'm a helper. I like to help clinicians do better research.
Right.
So when Ebola came around, I wanted to know more about Ebola, so I took off on an independent track to try to see what is the reality, is what the public health people are saying about Ebola correct? Are the virology, what's really happening? And I decided to write a book on Ebola, and then I wrote a couple of books after that, Cures versus Profits and the Environmental and Genetic Causes of Autism. And along the way, I discovered the vaccine safety science was crap. And that's the only, nicest thing that I can say about it. The vaccine safety science is fake science. It's done intentionally to fool the public into thinking the vaccines are safe. And that's a constructivist view from a philosophical standpoint.
Although, you know, I have to tell you, I try to pick out the top videos of the year. And last year, one of the top videos was the WHO meeting in 2019 in December in Switzerland, where what was made very clear by Dr. Lyson, who was the anthropologist, was that the pushback against vaccines was that there was no, you know, the doctors and parents wanted science proving that individual vaccinations were safe and effective, but also the cocktail in That's one right. small human body was safe and effective. And what was clearly admitted by the entire global group was there was no such science.
That's right. But a year before that, they never would have said that. It was a dramatic change, and that's why it's one of the number one videos. It's a good call on your part. So this idea that you can just, you know, fool the public into thinking something by constructing science and getting the results that you want, I call that science-like activities. It's not science. And so I have two sons. They're both going into science. They're both biologists early in their career. They're in high school at the time. One of them was in grade school at the time, actually. And I said, I want a future where they have science, where science actually has to survive, because they're just going to end up down some track where they're not asking interesting questions. The system's going to get a hold of them.
Right.
And so they messed with my baby. People who have vaccine injured children, I mean, people know my heart goes out to them like nothing you've ever seen. Well, when they mess with science, it's the same thing. They mess with my baby. So I'm carrying the flame of objective science forward in every area that's impacting public health. And when coronavirus hit and all the rest, we're going to talk about this in a minute, but when coronavirus hit, it's just been issue after issue after issue where this constructivist philosophy is imposed on reality instead of empirical science driving our understanding of reality. And that is a profound difference between Peter Hotez, Paul Offit, Anthony Fauci, and, you know, the people at CDC doing vaccine safety science and what I've created at IPAC. And you asked how could people find my work and how they could keep up with me? They could go to ipaknowledge.org. It's IPAK and then not, you know, knowledge. There's not two K's. ipaknowledge.org. They can also find all of my blog articles at jamesleinsweiler.com, jamesleinsweiler.com. But I also have a podcast called Unbreaking Science.
Right. That's very good. I just watched the one you did with Dr. Thomas and another. There were two other people. It was Thomas and one other.
Yeah, it's been great. It's taken off like a shot. It's kind of been hyper exponential. I woke up one day and I had done 100 episodes. I didn't even realize it. this is really super important because all of us are affected by these public health policies. I'm editor-in-chief of a journal I created. The URL is publichealthpolicy.com. journal.com, but it's Science, Public Health Policy, and the Law. So we're really meeting them blow for blow. When they put out some, you know, BS garbage, we do science and we see if it holds up. And I'm not a gadfly. I'm really just, people say, when did you change? And I say, I never changed. I simply remained a scientist.
Well, I think as a scientist, you understand how public policy based on pretend science can really kill. Yeah. You know, oh, so.
Absolutely. Right. Look at the treatments. Look at the denial of treatments.
Right.
Anthony Fauci said specifically in a microphone in public, we don't want too many people to get this virus because the vaccine won't be necessary. He wanted to cut off herd immunity. Flatten the Curve was a program to cut off herd immunity.
Right.
And shutting down the actual bona fide science that showed that hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin and the other treatments are effective, shutting down Dr. Brownstein and trying to harass him over his protocol, all of that was an attempt to make the vaccine the predominant force in the fight against coronavirus. And that is an unfortunate reality that we're faced with. So, you know, their profit motive is met by my love of, you know, humanity. Their profit motive to bias the science is met by my need to, my curiosity to understand how the world works.
Well, one of the reasons I so was glad that you were willing to come on the Solari Report, it's one thing for people to know the official story. If you're a subscriber of the Solari Report, you know the official story is not something you can trust because it's not coming from a source which has historically had integrity. But the challenge for busy people and busy families is, okay, where can we get information we trust? Yeah. And that's the key. So
I work very long hours. I get up at 6 in the morning. I go to bed, you know, past midnight and do
good
all over
heavens.
Again the next day. Well, there's so much going on. So there's so
we,
much
we
risk.
Want you, we're going to, prayer protection over you.
Well, thank you. There's hundreds of thousands of people that have died from lack of treatment to coronavirus.
Right. Well, they've died. I would say there are hundreds of thousands of people who died from lies.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so let's do something about that. Now, one of the people I picked up on, thanks to the group of people that... So I got into my interest in what was happening with the extraordinary vaccine injury and damage. For 10 years, I worked as an investment advisor, and many of my families were severely, the financial destruction of one family from one vaccine injury is incredible. You know, we all talk about this as though it's a healthcare issue, but it's also a financial issue that can have just astonishing impacts throughout several generations because it's so expensive and damaging, particularly when you don't know what just happened or how to get help, et cetera. So that's sort of what led me into. I was just trying to protect families from not just both physical injury and financial injury. And, of course, what I found was the biggest cause of financial failure in families with health related issues, and vaccine injury was one of them. Anyway, so one of the things I was fascinated by was when this wonderful doctor in Oregon, Dr. Paul Thomas, came out with a study. He took all the children he had had in his practice, some of which were unvaccinated, some of which were lightly vaccinated, and some which had followed the government schedules, and he was able to show and compare them through time. And the results were, needless to say, not pleasing to the Oregon Medical Board. But could you tell us a little bit about his study of the children in his practice and what it said?
Sure, absolutely. So that study was actually an IPAC study that was funded by my organization through donations from the public.
I didn't know that. Good for you.
Oh, yeah. I'm co-author on the study.
Okay.
So Paul had data from 15,000 patients. And what we did is we took all the patients that were born into the practice that actually showed up for multiple medical care after 3 months, so that it's a smaller number. We had 3,400 patients that were not vaccinated. I'm sorry, that were vaccinated.
Right.
And 561 that were not vaccinated. And what I did in my design of the analysis, I'm the guy that did the statistical analysis on it, is I said, listen, we're not going to look at, we're going to look at the incidence of disease, right? Outcomes like asthma, allergic rhinitis, and autism, ADHD. We're also going to look at the disease burden. How many times do these kids have to come back to the doctor for care?
Right.
And, you know, this has been criticized as an approach because the people criticizing it saying, well, these are just parents that are granola crunching moms. They have different lifestyles and, you know, there's a confounder there. And my point in the paper, actually, I anticipated this criticism and I said, basically, if these moms of these non-vaccinating families have whatever they're doing for their kids, we all have all pediatric science has to stop right now. And we have to talk to these 561 moms and figure out what magic raisins are feeding these kids because there's zero ADHD in the unvaccinated.
Wow.
Zero. And you know the size of the
market. So that means mothers who are feeding those kids GMO food are still not causing ADHD.
Well, I don't know if it's about the food. We looked at vax versus unvaccinated. The point is we have something's going on that's different in this population. If there's if there's zero ADHD, and Paul doesn't do the ADHD diagnosis, that's done off clinic. So there's no bias. These parents love him. They come to, we show that the healthcare visits, the well-child visits were the same across the axis of vaccination. Unlike fever goes up the more that you vaccinate, okay? So we really have a special approach on this entire study. And when I was writing the manuscript and preparing the results and putting it all together for Paul's review and looking at this, it was just stunning to me what we were finding. And I said to him, you are not going to believe what I've found. And he said, I live it every day. I know what you're going to find.
Right.
You know, it's abundantly obvious.
He sees it in the kids.
Right. So him being the clinician and me being the scientist, we put our heads together and we came up with the study looking at the relative incidence of office visits. And so now 5 days after, this was in November of last year, 5 days after we published it, the medical board suspended Paul's medical license.
Wow.
Now, the irony of this is that they had actually asked for these data, but they wanted a report, a private silent report, I guess, because they got scared. They looked at the results and they said, oh my God, this can't get out. So we're going to intimidate him. Maybe he'll retract the papers, whatever their motivation is.
Right.
It certainly wasn't scientific. And so that paper is actually under attack right now by somebody who's approached the journal with criticisms. We've addressed them and challenged the journal to allow open, rational discourse. Let the person who has the criticisms come, make the criticism. And
here's the thing, politically, they cannot afford the truth to come out.
Well, nothing's going to stop this truth from coming out because there's three more studies coming that I know of. There's three more studies that I know of. I can't go into details about them. But the reason why they can't allow the truth to come out about this study and about the realities of the effects of vaccines, higher amounts of asthma, higher amounts of gastroenteritis. We basically tested and confirmed we failed to falsify, I should say, the Wakefield hypothesis, that there's something strange about the gastrointestinal disease in kids that are vaccinating. Is the money. So pediatric practices, they bill for vaccines. There's administrative fees for vaccines. There's incentives for vaccines if you make a certain quota. And so Paul had financial data in his databases, and we decided to go in and look at a month's worth of data, looking at how much money he's actually sacrificing by providing informed consent and allowing for choice as required under Oregon state law. So he allows for titer testing to get out of the MMR. The state allows it. It's allowed by law. The medical board actually sanctioned him for doing that. So the question
for doing something that's within the law to do.
Right. Providing informed consent, right? Allowing them to skip vaccines that they want, informed choice, and for providing testing. This is the basis of the medical board's complaint. And the question comes down to who governs the state of Oregon? Does the medical board govern it or does the legislature? This is a legislature versus executive branch power struggle at this point.
Right.
The activists they understand this message. They're going after it. I think there's going to be a Senate hearing over this egregious act by the medical board, who has no regard for science. They don't like our study. They have no regard for the rule of law. So actually, Paul's in a very good position to fight from that standpoint. Now, when we did the financial analysis, we found that over 30 days, if you extrapolate the money that comes in, or that could have come in from vaccines that he could have administered, in a practice of 15,000 patients over 10 years, Paul has sacrificed $1 million a year.
Wow.
$1 million a year. One out of every $4 he could have brought
into
practice.
So if he decided to be a drug pusher instead of a doctor, he could have generated another million in revenues on his practice every year.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right. And then what this means is that pediatricians are profiting. You hear it all the time, right? I traveled for a couple of years around the country testifying to government organizations and committees and so on and legislatures, telling them that when I look at the scientific literature, the risk is present. The plausibility of the risk is present. It's there. There is no. It is not true that there's zero risk to vaccines. And so I heard the retort, yeah, but it's not a big deal. Vaccines, you know, pediatricians don't make any money from vaccines anyway. Well, this peer-reviewed report that has just come out, it's in the International Journal of...
I'm looking at it right now. I've got it right. It's a relative incidence of office visits and cumulative rates of bill diagnoses among the access of vaccination.
That's the VaxOnVax study. So
that's the Vax study. Okay.
So the study that we're talking about is actually it's published in the journal, the International Journal of Vaccine Research Theory and Practice, or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And John Oller's the editor on board there. And what this paper also showed was we took all the pathogens from that are vaccine targeted, okay, and the R naught value is the basic reproductive number. It's how many times an infected person, say with measles or with rubella, is likely to transmit before the disease resolves.
Right.
And we calculated from that R naught the percentage of coverage that's necessary for herd immunity. As I was traveling around for 2 years talking with legislators and educating them about the actual balance of the science, if you will, because they're being lied to by the medical community, I time and time again, I heard that they needed to take away mandates. So that they had to enforce mandates, they had to take away exemptions, vaccine right. exemptions, because more and more people are not vaccinating. Even in states where there was over 95% vaccination, they were trying to take these away.
Well, because it gives you a sample that is an alternative.
That's probably true.
Right.
Right. So here's the deal. In this paper, we not only show this massive profiting from vaccines, we also show in that table that for most of the pathogens that are targeted by vaccines on the CDC schedule, they don't need anywhere near 95% coverage for herd right. immunity, and they're already at 90-95% coverage. So why don't they just leave the vaccine risk-aware, anti-vax, so to speak, whatever, vaccine-injured families? And you said earlier that you were motivated by the injuries of vaccines. That's my motivation, too. These families are devastated. They're never going to accept a vaccine. They will move right. from state to state to state to avoid getting vaccinated because they have personal, firsthand, real-life knowledge of right. their experience with vaccine injury.
Now, right.
The all that science can do, so-called science, the fake science, could do is deny that. And this denialist agenda is a bulwark defense against any criticisms of vaccines, and it's written into the DNA of the CDC. They cannot right. allow any risk to be known. It's actually in the Federal Register that the right. U.S. public will never be told that there's any risk to vaccines. They cannot be allowed to know. Well, I'm sorry. I'm going to choose a path in my future where we have science-based, evidence-based approaches to public health, or we're going to run into a disaster. I was talking right. with Robert F. Kennedy Jr. about this, and I said to him, you know, if you have nuclear power plants on the planet Earth, what's the probability you're going to have a nuclear disaster meltdown? And he laughed, and he said, it's one. The probability is 1.0. We've had Fukushima, right? We had the Erie Canal, and, of course, we had Chernobyl. So if you have a national vaccine program on this planet Earth in any country, what's the probability at some point in the future you're going to have a national disaster? The probability is 1.0. We've already seen it. They're just denying it.
Right.
So
right.
we have to actually look at this from not an activist standpoint, but a return to science. Right. All I'm fighting for is a return to objective science. And if that makes me an activist, then I'm an activist for science, not an activist for anything else.
Right. But I think you're assuming that the goal of these programs is health related. And I don't necessarily assume that.
Oh, I totally get that. Let me tell you what I think about that. So the evolution of the efficacy of vaccines is buried. Nobody understands that. Very few people understand that when the measles vaccine, the mumps vaccine, first came out in the 1960s, of course they prevented the disease, they prevented the diagnosis, and they very likely also prevented the transmission because it was a one-to-one match with the wild-type virus.
Right.
Now, wait a couple of years. The wild-type virus is evolving away from the vaccine type. I'm an evolutionary biologist, and I actually calculate the rates of evolution.
Uh-huh.
The mumps vaccine was developed, the measles vaccine was developed, and it hasn't been updated since 1960. People that are born in 1960 right. are now 60 years old. We're dealing with 60-year-old technology. It's waning. First, there's a life cycle. There's waning immunogenicity, then waning efficacy, and then vaccine failure. And we see it with Bordetella pertussis. We see it with the pertussis vaccine. We see it with the mumps vaccine, with schools that are absolutely 100% vaccinated to schedule, but everybody got the mumps. Now, what did they do in the past? They said, we're going to get boosters. They can't do any more boosters because the vaccine schedule is full. They just can't do any more.
Right. So,
I think the original intention was, let's have health, right, prevent disease. But then it became, well, we're making so much money, they're liability free. We're making billions of dollars. If we actually reformulate the vaccine, we're going to have to go back to the FDA for reapproval. So then the financial interest took over. That's the cures versus profits. Yeah.
So I have a theory, and I'm not sure I want to interrupt this interview to get into it, but I think the problem the medical boards have is they're under tremendous pressure from the central bankers to put together, you know, and everybody politically in any state is under tremendous pressure to re-engineer how the political and governance system works, and this is caught up in it. And so, you know, that means the political pressure that can be applied behind the scenes is unbelievable and frightening.
Well, these are not elected officials that are making decisions for all of us, to the globalists. And so if by insisting on objective science, it conflates and confuses and confounds their agenda, that's a bonus. My point is, I understand that, Catherine, and I've seen it. You got to have your head under a rock to see how the globalists, you know, didn't take it. They took advantage of coronavirus like nobody else, right? Now we have this they got this great opportunity to take over the world.
So many years ago, I had a huge food. I made the mistake as a former government official and also a financial advisor in Washington to try and stop the housing bubble because there was tremendous amount of predatory and predatory lending and securities fraud. I mean, there was real criminality being engaged top down. Yeah. So I decided to do something about it, and it gave me a window on all the tactics they can use on a local bank or a local business or a state legislator or a county you know, it gave me an understanding of what the top-down political power, aka, you know, in my view, the central bankers can do. Yeah. When the New York Fed member banks decide to jam something, they can do it anywhere. It's phenomenal to watch, you know, their power.
Yeah.
And so it gave me a real appreciation of, you know, when a medical board in a state like Oregon gets pressured, I've seen the pressure that can be brought to bear. It's extraordinary.
Well, we're squeezing them right back. We're squeezing them with science. We're squeezing them with the pop. The activists are coming up. We know about their conflicts of interest. We know where they live.
That's why you have to, you know, because the system runs off of carrot and sticks, and it cannot stand up to real facts.
That's right.
So, and one of the reasons I do money is, you know, it lends itself to math and documentation, and you do science, and it's very similar. So I think real science matters tremendously.
Yeah, and I think what you're doing is important too, Catherine. It's so important to follow the money for sure.
Well, this is all about integrating everything. So tell me about, now, this latest study that you've done, when did it come out, and tell me what the reaction has been to it.
Well, it's only been out for about a week, so there hasn't been any official reaction.
Okay.
We saw it coming, you know, when it was accepted and being produced. But the population itself, the vaccine risk aware population, the people that I can reach, because I'm being censored, as you probably know, could guess, their response is, yeah, we knew that, right? But But here's what we have. We have a peer-reviewed documented report that they can take to their legislatures. When the legislatures say we have to have 95% coverage, or when a medical person comes in to testify, we're going to take away your exemptions, you need 95% coverage, you pull out table one from our study and our analysis, and you say, no, you don't. Show me here where it says that you have to have 95% coverage. You know the amount of coverage that you need for herd immunity for hepatitis B in infants is zero. Don't need any coverage.
Wow.
It's very close to zero. It's like 0.001 because they don't transmit it to each other by the nature of the way that it's transmitted. And so this is a really serious talking point. This analysis is huge. And it's open access. You can find it, and you can find it.
So when we come into your website, how do we find the study? Because I want to make sure I have it up on the commentary for this interview.
If you go to jameslyonsweiler.com, there's an article there that has my most recent studies. And you go to ipaknowledge.org, you can find it there too. There's a little write-up on it there.
So one thing we can do is we can make sure everybody sends this to their doctor or their nurse practitioner and gets this around.
Yeah, I would. Strategically thinking, when you get into the battle, if you're in a battleground state for exemptions, I would wait until somebody testifies from the other side and says you need 95%, or if they're already saying that, then bring it in and also show that the people who are testifying, if they say vaccine saves millions of lives and we need every child vaccinated, you know, every child by two, this kind of thing, show them the financial conflict of interest from the profits from vaccines. It's huge. It's a 1-2 punch in this analysis.
Right. And I think it's very helpful in the court of popular opinion, because it's what I've found is if you can show who's benefiting, you know, qui bono, you know, it really does change minds.
Absolutely. And that's why we're continuing with our vax versus unvax studies. We have another one underway. Looking at aluminum versus non-aluminum container vaccines. We're looking at live versus non-live. We're looking at combined use versus independent, you know, one at a time. Of course, Paul's book, Vaccine Friendly Plan, I'm going to bring it up here. He wrote this many years ago, the Vaccine Friendly Plan, with Jenna Margulis. And we actually compared his schedule to the CDC schedule with respect to the amount of aluminum in a peer-reviewed study, and we showed that in the CDC schedule, kids are in aluminum toxicity 100% of their days in the first year of life.
Right.
Okay, so in under Paul's schedule, they're only under aluminum toxicity like 5% of their days, and he thinks that's still too much because you get repeated exposures to aluminum from vaccines. You get repeated amounts of acute toxicity. What our analysis shows that no one else had shown is that you have chronic toxicity from aluminum.
Right.
Vaccine schedule, CDC's vaccine schedule. That has to change. That if I affect any change whatsoever in pediatric medicine, I would like to see them phase aluminum out completely. It is damaging our children completely. Russell Blaylock warned about this 20 years ago.
Right.
And now we're seeing the fruits of that with the highest ever rates of suicide in teenagers and schizophrenia, early Alzheimer's.
It's all neurological damage.
Yeah, it is, 100%.
Yeah. Shooting heavy metals into people's brains is not...
It's a bad idea.
Yeah, it's a very bad idea. Now, one of the challenges I've had with informed consent is if you read any informed consent form, it uses language that I, as a layman, just don't understand. And my father was a surgeon, so that's all I heard was medicine at the dinner table. And it's still, you know... it's one thing to say material adverse events. It's another thing to say a picture of somebody with Bell's palsy.
Yeah.
So that's number one. But number two, it was clear to me in the informed consent that there's no communication about what the financial ramifications are of vaccine injury. And I just think I operate in a world where the law requires a disclosure of anything that could impact your decision whether to go forward or not. So if anything has a material impact, you have to disclose that. So I'll never forget watching one mother who was interviewed during the Vax documentary, and she said, you know, a heavily autistic child is going to cost you $1 to $5 million present value over that child's lifetime. You know, and I went, wow, that's exactly sort of what I'm seeing by my random sample. And anyway, so when I started to look at the different proposals for informed consent for the COVID-19, I call them injections because I don't think it's vaccination. But anyway, I said, you know, if you look at the cost of, I mean, you're talking about taking a family provider and disabling them permanently. You need to describe what the potential financial ramifications are, because if somebody's going to take one of these injections, they've got to find a way to do it where it won't bankrupt the whole family. And this issue comes up in a situation, it used to happen to me a lot with grandparents, where a grandparent who was personally wealthy would say, well, my daughter is going to vaccinate my grandchild, and it's not my business. I said, well, it is your business, because sure. They don't have the $5 million and you do. So,
well, yeah, if when you look at it from a money standpoint, you're exactly right. So, you know, if you have informed consent, I agree, it should include a statement of that. Isn't it funny that it's a vaccinated healthcare workers, there is an epidemic of strange disease-like conditions across the healthcare worker population, right, that nobody could find what the underlying cause was, right?
Right.
Nobody could find that one common thing, Catherine, that caused these people to develop the idiopathic purpura or the thrombocytopenia or strokes, all of it. And their denialist agenda is them saying, that's your problem, not mine. We're going to externalize all that cost from the vaccine program, from your pediatrician, from the state.
Right.
It's on the people. But my issue right. is, where's the monument to these heroes, these families who have sacrificed loved ones, who have lost their wages because they only have one working parent? Where's the monument? If right, they're being denied. It's worse than just vaccine injury. It's being vaccine injured and then lied to about that it's not the vaccine. And there should be a monument right in front of the CDC that closes it forever. Just seal off the CDC with all the names of the people who died from vaccines over the last 30 years and all the people who had autism from vaccines over the last 30 years, so that we have a permanent reminder in the United States that we're never going to do this again.
Let me keep going because I want to just stay on the money.
Yeah.
The CDC's making money.
Yep.
The pharmaceutical companies are making money and have no liability.
Yep.
The legislators, the medical board, they're all making money. It's the families who are losing money, and it's not just the vaccine injured. It's all the siblings and the other people who are bankrupted or
right.
harmed. And they're taking all of the cost of this is being moved 100% to the families and the extended families and the communities.
That's right. They're externalizing those costs.
And so one group is making all the money, and the other group is taking all the losses.
So you'll be pleased to hear my theory on ethical capitalism. We need absolute massive reform in the West on capitalism, because
right.
in ethical capitalism, as I define it, there's two types of money. There's good money and there's bad money. Good money is, I have a brownie stand. I've made my brownies. I've used good, clean, wholesome ingredients. You give me $4 for a brownie, you walk away, I've got my $4 and you've got a good brownie.
Right.
Fair, it's, you know, good transaction. Bad money is, I went ahead and I used the bad eggs because I was going to undercut my cost of
right.
replacing bad eggs. I put the bad eggs in there. You get a brownie, it tastes just fine, but you go home and you're sick as a dog.
Right.
I externalized that cost. And I think we need to, in business schools, right? In business schools, we need to teach good money and bad money. We need to teach the ethics of externalizing costs. Instead, they teach it as a strategy to maximize profit. It's incredibly wrong that American-style capitalism allows profit from bad money.
So I wish I was in Pennsylvania, because I'd love to come talk to you about this. I've done a great deal of research and study over a lifetime on government money and how yeah. government process is rigged. Because if you can have transparency, so it will not surprise you to hear that the federal government is in complete violation and has been for decades of all their financial management laws and rules and regulations. But if you could have transparency around government money, county by county throughout the country, this kind of the shenanigans that we're dealing and you and Dr. Thomas are dealing with could not go on. Because it's non-transparency around the government money that finances most of the shenanigans that we're dealing with, and most of the shenanigans the central bankers need to do top-down control.
Oh, so, I agree. I had to sue the Allegheny County Board of Health just to have an open open comment period when they tried to mandate the HPV vaccine for all children.
Wow.
Yeah, and I won. It cost $15,000, and I won a stipulation from a judge because we have an Open Meetings Act. It's the Sunshine Act.
Right.
In Pennsylvania, and I sued them because the activists in the room videotaped the interaction when they were trying to shut me down. It was pretty dramatic. That same Allegheny County Board of Health received over $1 million grant to push vaccines, but they didn't say to push vaccines to the minority population. They said to provide health care services to these populations that they can't reach. They're having a hard time getting healthcare to the minority population. They call it healthcare. What we're really talking about is a particular kind of medicine. They're really pushing allopathic medicine vaccines.
Right.
They're not pushing osteopathy and chiropractic and other types of medicine. That's a violation of the public trust, because if they're funded by the government to promote well-being and health, they should be interested in everything from nutrition, starting with nutrition. And you know, one of my ways of correcting this ill is I created an online university called IPAC-EDU. IPAC-EDU, we have a course that's coming out right now, taught by Dr. Michael Gaeta, and it's the biology of nutrition from preconception to old age. Right. So when they do something like that, I don't get angry. I see it as an opportunity. There's a hole to fill. Right. So the infinite amount of billions of dollars that they have, I take their negative energy and transform it into something positive.
Right.
So I'm a bit unstoppable that way. And
so tell me about, you've been working with the Pennsylvania legislature off and on. Tell me, what do you think the response has been to the political leadership in Pennsylvania to science, to the availability of science and clear science about these issues?
I think it's great. I mean, the people don't understand the political outlay in Pennsylvania is that the Democrats or liberals, we should say, really, you know, neoliberalism runs the cities, but the rural areas are very highly conservative, classically conservative. And so much so that, you know, when I first moved here, I was surprised at how much a Johnstown Democrat was like a Johnstown Democrat was basically a Republican from upstate New York.
Right.
So there's this tapestry of political spectrum. But I've been invited to give educational seminars in Harrisburg by the promoters of choice, individual rights, you know, and health freedom. I was obviously invited to talk, you know, at that event there. And when I go, I make a point to never give my opinion on any particular piece of legislation, whether I'm for or against. I'm here to educate you about the science. You make up your own mind.
Right, right.
And that turns out to be shocking to hear them to many of them at first, but then they learn to appreciate it. In other places, I've been initially castigated by Democrats. You know, I come up the day after Mother's Day, I went to Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
I literally left the house with mashed potatoes and gravy in my mouth to get to the plane, right? Because Dell couldn't make it, Bobby Kennedy couldn't make it, Mary Holland couldn't make it. So I guess I was fourth on the list to people to invite. But I went there and I said, you know, I'm here to tell you about the science of this. And what had happened was they actually tried to shut me down. They knew who I was coming. I was supposed to get 30 minutes to talk. And they made me a public comment with 3 minutes.
Wow.
So their side had 5 experts, including a Yale epidemiologist. There was an expert on autism and so on. So they made a tactical error by having me go last. All I did was I took out a notepad and a pen, and I wrote down everything that the other people said was wrong, right? And then I grabbed one of the guys in the hallway and I said, I left my mother-in-law's house last night at 6 o'clock with mashed potatoes and gravy in my mouth to make it here. I was promised 30 minutes. If I don't get my 30 minutes, everybody's gonna know that I was ripped off for my 30 minutes. So they gave me my 30 minutes and I devastated the lies. I devastated the lies.
Is that filmed?
It's filmed. It's filmed. I devastated the lies, and I won't go into the details of what they said that was mistaken, but except for one, which was the Yale epidemiologist actually said that the measles is going to continue to be effective forever because the measles virus does not mutate.
Wow.
Well, I had plenty of time listening to that to get online, look up the mutation rate of the measles virus,
right,
and calculate from 1960 how different they were. And I reported that. I said, there seems to be some confusion here. It was like Columbo. I had Columbo moments, you know. I just one last question. You know, your Yale epidemiologist said that she didn't understand this, you know. And I want reality I want people to wake up to reality sooner than later, because it's harder later. It's more devastating to society later to wake up. You know, we have to incorporate reality into how we construct our lives, because it always catches up with you. You can't fool Mother Nature.
And, tell us now, let's turn to the FDA. You're just writing something to the FDA, or you've written it. Tell me a little bit about what's up.
Well, for the past 3 months, I've been doing a quantitative analysis of CDC's death determination and diagnosis paradigm for coronavirus.
Right.
Starting with people, you have people that are tested and some are not tested. You have the people who are tested, those who test positive, those who test negative. If you test negative or if you weren't tested, you can still be diagnosed with coronavirus. You're brought back in by the physician's opinion. And then later on, you have whether the virus is actually present, and was it a false positive? And then you have, was the virus present and viable? Was the virus present, causal, and viable and causal? So it's a thorough parameter sweep. And this is incontrovertible mathematically. It is the most tight analysis I think I've ever conducted, because I didn't have to have any empirical data. What I did was I said, take 670,000 people and put them through this decision tree. It's not even a full tree, that CDC says is the way to diagnose coronavirus.
Yeah. And the data is from the CDC?
No, it's a model of the CDC's diagnosis process.
Ah, okay.
So when they say you died with versus died from, okay?
Right.
If the virus is present, you died with it, no matter, even if you fell out of an airplane.
Right.
So this is what they did initially. So what I'm doing is I'm modeling how the relationships among all these variables, like the amount of testing. I was castigated in USA Today by a biostatistician from Michigan, and by I think a member of the CDC. I'm not sure. I can't remember. But anyway, I was castigated for daring to publish in my peer-reviewed journal an analysis that concluded that the CDC was exaggerating the number of deaths from coronavirus. As a realist, I want empirical-based, real science-based public health, right? I published that after thorough, extensive peer review. I wasn't the author on it. I was the editor-in-chief. And they cited the Institute for Pure Applied Knowledge, and they said, and the biostatistician was, he said that he thought that the most important parameter of interest was the amount of testing. And if we had more testing, then we'd have a more accurate number. But my analysis, Catherine, it turns out, in my analysis of the CDC's overarching paradigm of death determination and diagnosis of COVID-19, shows mathematically, the more testing you do, you don't just get a linear increase because you're finding more cases. You
right.
get a nonlinear increase because the false positive rate increases with more testing.
Right.
Now, this is a jaw-dropping result. So I sent it out for a paper to a journal, a public health journal, for peer review. And then after the day after that, I wrote to the FDA, and I'm asking them to establish an emergency panel of doctors, including Dr. Peter McAuliffe, Dr. Henry Ely, Dr. Sing Hang Lee, myself as a scientist, and there's a few others, so that we can review with them and give presentations with them on the reality of what's actually happening by virtue of their response and how they set things up. Now, I sent it to the FDA, and then I sent it to the CDC and asked them to make a joint panel so that they could do 180-degree turnaround on testing and on treatment. Now, the ball's in their court. If they take us up on this, then we might actually see a massive sea change in the way that people are given care. My own mother-in-law was tested positive for coronavirus. She tested herself after having a sniffle for 2 weeks, and the same sniffle she gets every year, but mm-hmm. she was listening to the television over and over and over again. She went out and got tested. She tested positive. Her husband, sitting in the car next to her, tested negative. She was told to go home and wait for 10 days to see if she needed emergency care, which means that there are old people that are doing that. They do what their doctors are told tell them to do. They go home with bacterial pneumonia and they die because they weren't given antibiotics. This
right.
is where the deaths are coming from. the deaths are coming from medical malfeasance. Now imagine if this presentation is given as a joint panel of all these doctors telling them, you guys have messed up. You're basically running us off a cliff. You're going to destroy Western civilization. If you keep doing these shutdowns, you're going to, the quarantines, they're unethical. They're not necessary. What you need to do is bring out early treatment. Maybe Pierre Corey, he's the other guy I want on the panel. Maybe they'll listen this time. But this, I think, is their last chance because we're pushing for the passports and pushing for all this other crap.
Goal is to get the passports, and you can't get the passports unless you have a pandemic, unless you need vaccinations. In other words, I think what you're watching is an effort to use fake science and fake health to achieve political ends.
I think so too, but there are certain things that even they have to listen to. For instance, right. What percentage of the GDP in the United States has been lost due to lockdown? Right?
I'm going to grossly oversimplify. You have two economies. You have Main Street and you have Wall Street.
Yeah.
And Wall Street has been able to gorge and feast on the cash flows that were shut down, that Main Street got shut down. So This is just a leveraged buyout of Main Street. And so I agree. Right.
So
I would say
America,
Wall Street's made a fortune.
I would too, and the testing is a fortune, and the vaccine is another fortune. What public health has done is they've taken over in a dictatorial way, not just society, but specifically allopathy, where they told all of medicine, you cannot make any money, you have to shut down, you can't see any patients. That starved them of the revenue, and then they said, right. Well, wait a minute, for every patient that you diagnose, we'll give you $40,000 or whatever it is.
Right.
And by the way, here's this new cash flow from testing. So
right.
You have these revenue centers that are massive in these hospitals, and the CEOs
right.
are happy. They can redistribute and so on and keep everybody paid and keep the ball rolling, keep the fraud rolling. But here's the deal. What are they going to do, Catherine, when you've got 40% false positive rates and 90% of the population is vaccinated and 40% of 90% still get coronavirus after the vaccine? Then what? So they do have an incentive.
But they don't care about that.
Well, they do, because it's going to show that the vaccine is not working. It's going to show that there's no reason for passports. And the other thing that we're actually going to educate them on in spades is, and this brings up the NATAC consortium, where we have data that shows that the PCR-based testing is absolutely positively misleading in terms of number of cases.
Right, but the goal of the passport is control. So what they want is a financial transaction system.
I understand that. That's why I'm doing
it. Right. If you don't behave, they can turn off your money. So it's a control system.
Totally.
And all of these things are justification to install their control system.
Totally. So
right.
So what we have is a consortium of scientists are going to go ahead and sequence coronavirus samples to see if it's coronavirus, influenza A, influenza B, bacterial pneumonia, is it a fungal?
Uh-huh.
So we have this NATAC consortium. IPAC's part of it. You can join it by donate by going to ipaknowledge.org. We're going to raise $300,000 to
uh-huh.
fund Dr. Singhang Lee to actually take clinical samples from around the country and could do total sequencing for all these pathogens. So it's not just PCR. And so we're
right.
going to show what the true false positive rate. We're going to show the true pathogen specificity. The data will say the only way to go forward with meaningful nucleic acid-based diagnosis is sequencing. The FDA has fought back on this. Dr. Marks has fought back with Dr. Lee on his applications.
Uh-huh.
And we're changing the world here. And if, again,
yes,
like I said
are.
Earlier,
you really are. I can attest to that.
If by chance that also leads to the failure of the passport program, then so be it, because it wasn't related to reality.
So I think there's nothing more important to the health of the American citizen and the global citizen is making sure the passports fail.
You nailed it. And so what right. I'm saying is, I just have a different way of communicating it.
No, your way of communicating is excellent. I'm sorry, go ahead.
We found the cornerstone. We found the peg that if you pull the peg out, the whole thing falls apart. All right. So the CDC and the FDA, they have huge incentive because there's hundreds of doctors and physicians and scientists that are on board with this. And we are absolutely taking the fight directly to them. reaching out a hand to say, we're going to help you turn around. You're doing it wrong. If they don't do it, we're going for a grand jury investigation. So the other side of the coin is good cop, bad cop. So they really don't have a choice. We have all the data we need to get a grand jury investigation going, and citizens in the United States can get them going.
Right.
We're actively working on that as another approach. IPAC's not the driver in that, but that's the bad cop. We're the good cop, they're the bad cop.
There's a wonderful expression that came out of the World War II called it's a German word. It means death killer. And it's time to start holding people, you know, the death killers accountable for, they're literally murdering people.
Totally. I mean, to take a look at the Fauci being guilty of hundreds of thousands of people who would have survived if they had early access to hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin and so on.
So one of the things I'd like to do as a result of our discussion today is send an introduction to Dr. Mark Skidmore. Do you know who he is?
I don't.
Dr. Mark Skidmore is a professor of economics at the Michigan State University.
Okay.
And a very serious economist. And he was listening to me describe that in 2015, $6.5 trillion had gone missing from DOD. And he said, oh, well, she has to be wrong. Anyway, he went to DOD, looked up their financial documents, and discovered, no, I was right. So he ended up sending me an email and saying, how can I help you? So we decided to do a survey. I had never done a full survey of, there are two agencies where money has been going missing in size. One is DOD and the other is HUD, where I used to be assistant secretary. So he had a group of students who were available, and we did a full survey from 1998 to 2015 of all their financial documents and discovered that I was wrong. It wasn't $12 trillion that was missing. It was $21
trillion.
Anyway, we did a series of publications over, if you go to missingmoney.solari.com, we published lots of the federal government documentations, and he's been on quite a journey to understand why I say there's been, you know, we are dealing with a financial coup, and I think the pandemic is being used to consolidate that financial coup. But anyway, so he decided the other day, I got an email from him, and he said, you know, I'm doing an analysis of how many deaths, as an economist, how many deaths were unnecessary as a result of withholding these different treatments. Anyway, so he's been working on an estimate, and knowing him, he's an extremely careful, thorough person. And somehow I just feel, given what he's working on, he should be in cahoots with you.
Yeah, I did definitely need to talk with him. I mean, I hope to publish his paper in my journal when he writes it up.
I'll send an introduction.
We've approached this problem at IPAC a couple of times. What percentage of the excess deaths are actually due to misdiagnosed, you know, other respiratory illnesses? That's an important parameter he might not have access to, so I'd be happy to talk with him.
Okay, so let's bring this back to action. I want you to go again. Let's talk through your websites.
Sure.
So give your websites again, and is there an opportunity in any of them? Do you have an update list where you keep people updated by email, or you send out emails?
The best way for people to get my updates is to text IPAC, IPAK, to 474747.
Okay.
And then when we have important announcements, we ship them out by texting.
We
do have an email list that you can sign up for at jameslyonsweather.com. If you follow and follow that blog, you'll also get updates every time we publish something there.
Okay.
What I'd like to do is send people to ipaknowledge.org, and if you like everything we're doing, find the generic donation.
Okay.
You know, we're a not-for-profit in Pennsylvania, but we're not a 501c3 yet. We're talking with the State Department about how to get that done when coronavirus hit. So they said, just wait until it's over. So we'll probably never become a 501c3.
Well, you know, I would recommend that to you because I think if you look at the rules and regulations that come, it's not worth it.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought it would be a great kind of like star on us to be a pure public charity, but I'm over that. There's way too much to be done. So they've left us alone, and we're just going to continue doing our business, apparently. But, you know, that means that your donation is not tax deductible. And I have to say that since I'm fundraising, but there's a monthly donation option. everything that I've done is funded by small monthly donations. I mean, there's one or two larger donors, but everything that I've done is funded by a small donation. So you
so we have something called a Take Action Crowdfund, and it's groups we recommend on basically sort of fighting this. So with your permission, I'll add that to the Take Action Crowdfund.
Oh, that'd be great. Thank you.
Okay.
That'd be fantastic. Thank you.
Okay. Now, give that now, IPA stands for the Institute for Pure...
And Applied Knowledge.
And Applied Knowledge. And give us the URL for that again.
IPAKnowledge.org.
.org.
IPAKnowledge.org. You'll also find the NATAC Consortium there. People are donating $100, $500, because it's really important that we empower this laboratory to sequence these clinical samples. So if we could show that something that was diagnosed as coronavirus is actually another respiratory virus,
right?
You know, this is a like a linchpin. You know,
it's now, where do we fund that?
That's at the IPAC website. At as
IPAC.
Well.
So, yeah.
So the look around. There's a lot of information there. Look
yeah,
around it.
There is. I can attest to that. Okay, well, this has been fantastic. I can't thank you enough for what you're doing, and it's very gratifying. Now, I'm going to make sure we get this all up. It's accessible, but on the way to stopping the vaccine passports and the end of science, if there's anything I and the Soleri audience can ever do to support you, just, you know, feel free to send out a scream.
Well, thank you so much. I'm being totally suppressed on YouTube, so I will send you.
You know, Catherine. It's so funny. I have to tell you this. You're absolutely right. If you go to YouTube and put in your name, what you will get are hundreds of videos on why you should get the COVID-19 injection. They've got you totally smothered.
Right. So the ask, I guess, would be to, I'll send you a link to one video. I want to test a hypothesis.
Okay.
That YouTube is throttling me at 2,600 views. So they're not reporting all the views to me. And I'd like to get thousands of people to watch one video.
Okay.
And so I'll send you that one link and then subscribe to the channel and then share and try to blow this up because, you know, we're distributing our videos elsewhere. Okay. I'm not really worried about YouTube.
Right.
But, you know, Facebook and I have a particular relationship as well. It's very weird why I'm still on there. But it may have something to do with the letter that I wrote to Mark Zuckerberg, challenging him to keep, right? Early on in all of this, I said, you have created a platform that will allow free speech and history will remember what you do and all of this. So we'll see. But I'm with you.
Did you see the letter that Bhakti and a group called the Doctors for COVID Ethics wrote to the European Health Agency? And it's if you go to Soleri.com, we have it on the homepage. It's a rebuttal. They had written a letter. They'd gotten a response that they considered insufficient. They wrote back and they gave them a notice of liability under the Nuremberg Code.
Yeah, well, that's important. It's important to let them know that we're actually, you know, there was a person that testified yesterday in California. She was fantastic. I'll send you the link. I forgot her. Leah starts with a P. Anyway, she basically cited the chapter and code about what we learned from World War II, and that she knows exactly what will happen to them when the rest of humanity wakes up, and she's given them fair warning. So,
right,
yeah. This is very serious business, and I'm in it. I want the families to know, the people who are suffering due to this oppression, that I'm with you every day. You're my driving force. You're the same with Catherine. You're the reason why we do what we do. I'm not in this for the money. That's for sure. I could have gone to Johns Hopkins University and made a lot more money personally. So
yes, but you'd be sick.
Oh my gosh! I'm so happy not being in academia. I have true academic freedom. Imagine that, right?
One of my favorite scenes, I have to tell you, Dr. Stella Manuel down in Houston was promoting her success with hydroxychloroquine, and they sent a hitman out. They're these really slick young journalists, and they're great hitmen. They're sort of like the Andrew Sorkin in training. So they send this hitman out, and he's saying, and he's really trying to work her and implying that if she doesn't, you know, if she doesn't backpedal, she's going to have the medical board come after her. She's going to lose her license. And this woman, you know, has seen, she grew up in Africa, so she's not afraid of guys like him. She leans over and she looks at me and she says, let me ask you a question. How many people should I let die so I can keep my license? Yep. And he got afraid. And he realized, okay, you know, what I'm doing is probably a felony.
That's much more effective than me in communicating. That's a good way.
Oh,
how many scientific studies should I fake to be able to be in academia?
Yeah, you want to ask him for a price. You know, how much will you pay me to fake the science? You know, what's the price? You know, because I want a little pricing number here. Okay. Well, Dr. Lyons-Weiler, you're the best. Keep going.
Thank you.
If we can put gas in our in your tank, we will do our best to do so. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you. I'm eternally grateful, and thank you, and be well, and thanks again. Just
forward
gratitude.